Today's Animal Spirits Talk Your Book is brought to you by Schaefer Cullen Capital Management. Go to cullenfunds.com to learn more about their emerging markets high dividend fund. That's cullenfunds.com.
Welcome to Animal Spirits, a show about markets, life, and investing. Join Michael Batnick and Ben Carlson as they talk about what they're reading, writing, and watching. All opinions expressed by Michael and Ben are solely their own opinion and do not reflect the opinion of Ritholtz Wealth Management. This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon for any investment decisions. Clients of Ritholtz Wealth Management may maintain positions in the securities discussed in this podcast.
Welcome to Animal Spirits with Michael and Ben. On today's show, we are covering emerging markets. A lot of people are looking at like investing now and they're saying, I can't invest now with the market at all-time highs. And I guess when I say a lot of people, who's the source? You know the meme, I made it up?
Me.
Many people.
Yeah, you're right.
Many people are saying this.
The stock market is overvalued and where am I supposed to put my money?
Yeah. Well, there are other areas of the world that have not had nearly the same success over the last 5 to 10 years as the mega cap stocks in the S&P 500. Emerging markets is certainly near the top of the list.
So we've been talking about emerging markets being relatively cheap for a while, and they always kind of trade at a discount to the US, but they've just sucked wind in terms of performance for well over a decade now. And I think I've come around to the idea, we've been talking about like, what's the catalyst for this, right? What would cause foreign stocks or emerging markets to outperform? And I think it's just the dollar, which we get into this. Like, I think if the dollar were weak for a prolonged period of time, you would see emerging market stocks do really well. Is that fair?
Well, have you seen the deficit? It's coming.
That's true. If you're an anti-deficit, government spending, government debt kind of thing, emerging markets are, that's where you put your money, right?
What if gold and emerging markets are the big one for the next decade? That would throw people for a loop.
That was the lost decade of the first decade of the century. So, but anyway, we got into a lot of really good stuff on India and China and the opportunity set in emerging markets and the crazy high dividend yields that you can get there too, which are way higher than the United States. So we talked to Raul Sharma, who is a portfolio manager, and he's been doing this apparently for about as long as anyone in emerging markets. He's been doing it for over 20 years. Really, really sharp guy. So we learned a lot from him.
Yeah, this was a good one.
Excellent conversation. Here is our talk with Raul.
We're joined today by Raul Sharma. Raul is a portfolio manager and an executive director at Schaefer Cullen Capital Management. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Michael.
All right. Today, we're going to be talking about emerging market equities, and maybe let's start here. So from the perspective of a U.S.-based investor, things have not been great over the last decade. Emerging market stocks have done 3.6% a year. That's a 43% total return versus the S&P 500, which has obviously crushed it, doing 13% a year for a total return of 235%. The reasons for how we got to where we are now are very well documented. The tech trade, like we get it. If you had to put your crystal ball on, that doesn't make sense. If you had a crystal ball, what would you guess would be the reason why emerging markets could outperform U.S. stocks over the next decade?
Well, I think, you know, the emerging markets are so diverse. So there have been several emerging markets that have been doing very, very well, but everyone is just so focused on China, and China is such a large weight in the emerging market index. And China has been really underperforming, and that more than anything has caused the emerging markets to underperform. But if you look at other markets, like say Mexico or India or Indonesia or Taiwan, those markets have actually done very, very well. And in some cases, they've actually outperformed the S&P 500. And a lot of the same drivers that are driving the U.S. market, namely tech, there's a lot of that in emerging markets. In places like Taiwan and South Korea, you can get very good exposure to things like AI and semiconductors and that sort of thing that are also doing very, very well. One of the other problems has probably been the dollar. I mean, typically there's a very strong correlation for when the dollar weakens. That's usually a very good thing for emerging market stocks. And seeing that the dollar's outperformed for the last decade or so, we definitely think we're getting into a period where you might start to see kind of a reversal of that trend. And I would expect that to be a big catalyst for, all emerging markets. In the meantime, I expect those certain emerging markets to continue to do very well. And, you know, you got to watch China. You never know if China is going to improve. It's a very sizable economy. They're pretty much the biggest consumer of, most products globally. So you know, while we're quite underweight China, I wouldn't say that China is, say, uninvestable.
I was going to ask you actually about the currency side of things here. Maybe you could explain for the audience just why it matters when the dollar is strong that emerging market stocks tend to do poorly.
Well, a lot of certain emerging market countries and companies might have a lot of U.S. dollar denominated debt. So, you know, as the dollar strengthens, that debt gets more expensive. The interest expense, you know, starts to rise. So that's, you know, a big reason for it, I would say. You know, and usually when the dollar is strengthening, you're generally talking about kind of a risk, or oftentimes you're talking about a risk off environment, which is usually not a good thing for emerging market stocks as well.
So with China as such a large percentage of just passive indices these days, there's a lot of money coming out of China, right? Foreign investment is just going the wrong direction. But when I see calls for EM ex China or China is uninvestable and their stock market already in a 70%+ drawdown, I don't know. I tend to think that, like, it's not to say that things have to get a lot better, but what if they're not catastrophic? What if they're just really bad? Like, that in and of itself could potentially spark a nice rally. What I'm saying is, and maybe this is wishful thinking, is anybody pessimistic? I mean, sorry, optimistic on China? Like, isn't all of the bad news baked into the pie already? Or a lot of it?
I think sentiment is pretty terrible on China. And I mean, I've been doing this for almost 25 years, and I've never seen it as bad as it is in terms of either the sentiment or the overall economic activity. But I do think it's kind of bottomed out, and I think it's just going to generally improve. And then there's areas of the Chinese economy that are doing a lot better than other areas. So if you look at things like, say, travel and tourism, that's an area that's doing quite well. I mean, domestic travel is well beyond pre-COVID levels, and now outbound travel is really, really picking up. So we own a few kind of travel and tourism related stocks that are doing pretty well. You know, there's also been this, you know, general change in the way people think about travel. A lot of younger people, you know, are really more after experience rather than materialistic things. So that's helping travel a lot. And then also having these kind of hybrid work environments now makes it a lot easier to maybe get a 3-day weekend or a 4-day weekend in another place. And, you know, you could still maybe work a day. And so so that's one example. There's other areas of where the Chinese, certain Chinese companies are just extremely dominant. I would say electric vehicles would be one example of that. If you look at companies like BYD, you know, they're now selling more electric vehicles than even Tesla, and their cars are quite competitive. If you look at battery technology, if you look at companies like CATL, you know, they are by far the leaders in battery technology, way ahead of everyone else. Really dominant in that area where they have, you know, something like 40% global market share. And like I said, that big lead. So those, to the extent we have exposure to China, you know, those are kind of the areas that we like to be involved in. But I still think there's better ideas outside of China. Because again, just like you said, there's money coming out of China. Either people aren't investing in emerging markets, or they're reinvesting from China into other emerging markets. So markets like India, Mexico, Indonesia, you know, and other markets are seeing very, very strong fund flows. And if it was just that, I'd say that's a problem. But it's also coinciding with a lot of huge long-term opportunities, things like nearshoring and reshoring, where people are trying to, you know, relocate their supply chains to places like Mexico or India, first because of the problems that supply chains had during COVID, but now because of the geopolitical tensions between China and the U.S. We have AI. Everyone's talking about AI. So there's a lot of stocks in Taiwan and, like I mentioned, South Korea that are really benefiting from that. Climate change is another big thing. You know, I mentioned the EVs, you know, finding the companies that are, you know, providing the products and solutions to address climate change concerns. And so those same markets where the fund flows are going into are also benefiting from these trends, and that's creating excellent opportunities in those markets.
So Michael mentioned the fact that the pessimistic side of things for EM is pretty well documented. It's funny because it was the opposite heading into the 2010s, where everyone said, well, the only place you can find growth is in emerging markets, and they have, you know, billions of consumers, so that's the place that you want to be. And it turned out to be the opposite. And I think one of the things a lot of US-based investors have figured out is that, well, you don't get to hold a lot of your returns from the corporations in some of those countries. So how do you ensure that you actually do get those returns, and it's not something that is the government regulation is taking away and making sure that they're not getting those same returns from their companies?
Yeah, I mean, we're just really focused on kind of really kind of simple stories that are, you know, we're very, very focused on earnings growth. So, you know, even though we're value investors, you know, we're very focused on the earnings growth. We tend to be quite thematic in nature. I mentioned some of those themes that we're exposed to, whether it be something like AI, or, you know, we have a lot of exposure to this nearshoring, reshoring, and also to the consumer, like you mentioned, that still is a very good long-term story, particularly in Asia. And so if you just focus on companies that are kind of selling into those areas, you can get very good growth. And we also pay a lot of attention to things like corporate governance. That's much more of a problem in emerging markets. There's just a lot more kind of value traps potentially in emerging markets. And so you need a lot of tools to be able to avoid those. And we're quite experienced and quite focused on doing that.
Are there certain countries that you avoid altogether? How do you think about that side of things?
Well, these days, obviously, Russia, we can't invest in there. We do a lot of country research. So that's one of the things when we first started these strategies really back, or really started investing in EM really back in 2001. We noticed it was a little bit different than what we were doing in the US. And usually it was because of country factors. And if you look at empirical research, you'll see that country selection matters just a lot more when you invest in emerging markets. So we had to kind of come up with a framework to analyze countries. And we started publishing a country report that we do every year, where we basically rank and assess countries on a broad array of metrics. We go beyond the stocks. You know, we're looking at bond markets. We're looking at economic statistics. We look at a lot of, you know, kind of surveys on you know, the ease of doing business. We look at their past experience in certain crises. And doing all this helps us identify the strengths of certain countries. And that helps us, you know, identify maybe, you know, certain types of companies within countries, because we always love to leverage the strength of a country through a company. But then it also points out some of the vulnerabilities that countries have. And so, and probably the biggest problem, this gets back to that dollar issue we were talking about, is when an emerging market country has a weak external position, when they have a lot of debt, when they don't have a lot of reserves, when they have twin deficits, that tends to lead to big currency depreciations, which then could lead to kind of, you know, blowups in certain emerging markets. So we tend to be a lot more selective, or really not even invest in those sorts of countries. The good news is that they're not a big part of EM. They're just much smaller countries, like say a Turkey or Argentina, that don't have large weights. But that's one of the tools we use to kind of avoid those pitfalls. And sometimes you also get very, very good opportunities. Greece was a very good example of a country that you really wanted to avoid after it had a huge crisis many years ago. But when you looked kind of 5 or 10 years later, all of a sudden things had really turned around a lot. The government really changed. It went to a more business-friendly government. They put in a lot of sound economic development policies. They refinanced their debt at low rates. And they benefited from a lot of the kind of changes that have happened during COVID and because of the wars too. And so all of a sudden, Greece went from being a pretty weak market to one of the best performing markets in the world. And, you know, that's a market that we're actually overweight.
Greece was up 43% last year. I would not have guessed that.
Yeah, it's still cheap. If you look at the valuation, it's still, you know, one standard deviation below its long-term average on either a PE basis or a price-to-book basis. So we still like that market a lot.
You said you're a value investor, and you mentioned that Greece is still attractively priced. How do these companies or countries get re-rated? Does there need to be a catalyst, or can it generally just be, I don't know, value finds a way?
I think it's both. I think certain companies, you know, within a country that might not be performing well will still perform well because they have very good, you know, company factors and they're kind of firing on all cylinders. And so there's, you know, examples of Chinese companies that are doing quite well over the last couple of years, even though that market hasn't. And then, yeah, you get these huge re-ratings of a country. Like we mentioned, Greece, or probably the best example of a re-rating would be India over the last 10 years. And usually it's when governments change. And like I said, you get a combination of a less corrupt government that's more business friendly, that puts in sound economic development policies, and then in a country that just has a lot of potential. So if you look at India with, you know, 1.5 billion people, yet per capita income, it's still only 2,000, you know, US dollars. There's just huge opportunities for growth. You know, there's a lot of management talent in India. There's just a labor advantage with 450 million young people that often speak English. So, you know, that allows a country to kind of start firing on all cylinders, and that could create great long-term opportunities. And that's basically what's happening in India and to a lesser extent, Greece. And there's other markets too, like Mexico, like Indonesia, like Vietnam, that I think you could say a similar thing.
India is one of the hottest markets right now. I'm curious, what are the leading companies, maybe not companies specifically, but what are some of the sectors that are driving those returns higher?
Yeah, the whole market has been doing well. You know, certainly, you know, the big conglomerates, which are probably the companies people know best, the Adanis and Reliance Industries of the world, they've been, you know, performing reasonably well. But it's actually been the SOEs more recently and some of the kind of SMID caps that have been doing well. And by SOEs, I mean state-owned enterprises, because usually we don't like state-owned enterprises in emerging markets. That's usually where you do see a lot of governance problems and you see a lot of value traps in markets like China or Russia. And that's usually because these companies are not really acting in the interest of shareholders, but rather they're acting in the interest of the state. And that becomes a problem. But when you get a really technically sound government that is making just frankly brilliant economic development plans, you know, really over the last decade, all of a sudden those SOEs become a big beneficiary of that. And they're often the means to which these, you know, development plans are kind of implemented. And so you've seen a lot of the utility stocks do really well in India. That's an area that we own because that was still an area where you could find cheap stocks to pay dividends. They're doing well because, you know, India is growing. And so there's a lot of demand for electricity, but probably even more so, they all have some exposure to renewables. And if India has one problem, well, one of the problems India has is pollution, certainly. So, they're making a huge push into renewables and there's just a ton of money coming into the sector. And so a lot of these utilities have really, benefited from that. So that's an area where, you know, we've really been able to do well in our fund and still more or less like the exposures. Some of the banks, I mean, anytime you have an economy doing well, like whether it be Indonesia or Mexico or, you know, India, and you're seeing strong macro trends, banks tend to do well. So that's another area where we've had some exposure that's also done very well in India.
How do you think about some sort of valuation discount there? Because a lot of people have been saying for years that the U.S. deserves to have a valuation premium to the rest of the world. And then places like some emerging markets and maybe even Europe actually deserve to have a discounted valuation multiple. How do you think about that when building a framework for thinking about what the right valuations should be?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's true. I think it's hard to argue that the U.S. should have a premium. I mean, there's just, you know, things about the U.S., the ease of doing business, the rule of law, you know, the dominance of the technology companies that probably warrant that premium. But the question is how much of a premium? So if you look at valuations now, emerging market stocks, if you look at, say, the MSCI EM index, it's trading about 12.5 times earnings versus the S&P 500 trading at 21.5 times earnings. So EM is, you know, over 40% cheaper on a PE basis, and it has double the dividend yield just on an index level. And then, you know, value managers like ourselves are even cheaper than the EM index. So to me, that's way too much. You know, that maybe you should get, you know, on average a 10 or 15% discount, but I don't think it should be that much. And so that allows for the opportunity for a re-rating. And then within certain markets, you probably shouldn't have, you know, much of a discount at all. Like India probably does deserve to trade at a similar multiple as the US because, like I said, that things are going just so well in that economy. And then you have other markets like Mexico and Greece, which are also doing very, very well, but they're still really quite cheap when you really look at them. So there's a lot of opportunities there too. So, you know, so it's just not on a P basis. It's even probably more dramatic on a price to book basis. So that's how we think about it. You know, how much should the discount be, both, you know, kind of overall and then on a company specific basis as well.
How important are demographic trends in your process?
They're important. They're, you know, we definitely like favorable demographics. That's another thing we love about like places like India, or even, you know, that's one of the advantages that Mexico has always had. And it's the reason why people are outsourcing so often to Mexico, because they have a pretty good skilled labor force. You know, it's definitely a problem for places like China in terms of a shrinking kind of labor pool. And also in places like Eastern Europe, where you have quite an older kind of demographics. We also think about it just in terms of, you know, opportunities. I mean, things like kind of like healthcare are kind of interesting when you see demographic trends, you know, because unfortunately, as you get older, you do tend to use more, you know, kind of healthcare services. And then we mentioned like the consumer in emerging markets in places like India, that's, you know, something we want to be exposed to. Or you look at how changes in behaviors among certain demographic groups, like we were mentioning travel and tourism, that also can create opportunities. So it's definitely something we look into, and we do think it's important.
Your strategy is called the emerging markets high dividend strategy, which is kind of funny because in the US, it seems like most investors have kind of just let go of the dividend thing from the overall market perspective. The NASDAQ 100, I don't know, it's a 1% dividend. S&P is probably, what, 1.7% or something, 1.6%. So what are the differences there in terms of the kind of dividend yields you can find in companies in the emerging markets?
Yeah, I mean, you wouldn't believe, and that's, I always say that emerging market dividend paying stocks are the best kept secret for income seeking investors. We do have a bit of flexibility with the mandate too. The mandate is that 90% of the companies will have a dividend yield of 2% or more at cost when we invest in them. But the other 10% might have lower yields, and there might be other things we like about them, like just their pure valuations or whatever it might be. But like I said, there's such a diverse you know, set of companies. Like who would have ever thought that the biggest driver of our relative performance last year would have been AI? I mean, no one would have thought a value dividend manager would be able to get that exposure. But, you know, you can just load up on companies that are, you know, basically supplying the Magnificent Seven that pay dividends and that are cheap, like I said, in places like, you know, Taiwan. So it's quite a diverse opportunity set. And I think it's just almost kind of more important in emerging markets because it gets to that governance factor that usually companies that pay dividends do have better corporate governance, and corporate governance is so important in emerging markets. So it's kind of a good way to start, you know, to kind of get to where you want to be in terms of getting into higher quality companies, you know, in EM. And I think that's more important in emerging markets than say in the US. So that's kind of how the dividend opportunities look outside. You know, we're usually, our dividend yield is usually about 60 to 100% higher than the index. So we're currently over a 5% dividend yield.
Wow.
Yeah. So there's a lot of opportunities out there.
I'm curious how you think about portfolio construction. Do you view it through the lens of, okay, these are like our sector constraints, or we're bullish on this country, we want to be underweight that country? How does a portfolio management process work?
Yeah, I mean, we are officially benchmark agnostic, but you know, we do have certain concentration limits on position size, country size, and exposure to any industry. But, you know, that doesn't mean that we can't, you know, have big conviction in certain markets and have huge overweight. So, you know, we've been 10 times the index in places like Greece, 4 times it, in places like Mexico. So obviously those are markets that we like, but we're really looking at, we're very rarely are we saying, all right, we want to get overweight this market. It's more of a bottoms up process. We're looking for companies, you know, in markets, and then, you know, maybe we can get to an overweighted position if we like the companies enough. But like I said, there's oftentimes kind of a, you know, that works out pretty well because a lot of the things that make you like the country are the things that the company is kind of capitalizing on. And so it leads to kind of good, you know, kind of growth opportunities. So that's how we think about, you know, portfolio construction. We also like price momentum a lot, believe it or not, as a value investor. So a lot of times you'll see the bigger positions in our portfolio, they've become that way because they are benefiting from positive price momentum trends. And you know, we love to let our winners run. You know, we do not just keep doubling down on our losers. As long as the thesis is intact and the stock has positive price momentum and the valuations are reasonable, we're going to keep holding on to it.
So you use momentum as more of a way to like entry and exit signals?
Yeah, I mean, what we do is when we're doing fundamental research on companies, we have bull bear base case scenarios for each company we invest in, where we kind of stress certain macro factors and obviously company factors to come up with a bull price target, and then also a bear kind of worst case scenario price target. And we like to compare the one to two to the one to the other to develop kind of a risk reward ratio, the bull to the bear. And when we're getting kind of like 2 times the upside compared to the downside in the bear scenario, we tend to get more excited. And that's another, you know, thing that helps us develop more conviction in some names versus others.
How big is your universe when you're picking stocks? How big is the opportunity set in emerging markets? And then how much do you winnow it down to the number of holdings you have?
Yeah, I mean, it's a huge opportunity set, but like, you know, I'm going to say there's something like 20,000 EM stocks, but then a lot of them are not very liquid or very, very small. So we do like investing in SMID caps, but we have a limit of about 15% of the portfolio that will invest in SMID caps because we want to have proper liquidity. But we do like to leverage that. So when you start taking out the kind of minimum liquidity requirements and market caps, you're probably looking at about, you know, 4,000 stocks that you can invest in. And then we're doing the screens on those stocks, looking for low PE, above average dividend yield, and dividend and earnings growth. So these days, that's getting to us about down to about 800 or so stocks that meet those screening parameters. It's a universe we know very well because I believe I've been doing this in this space longer than anyone globally, going back to like 2001. So if you give our team the universe, we feel like we know it better than anyone. And so that's clearly an advantage. And not only that, you know, there's only about, you know, maybe say 40 or 50 stocks that when we look at the screen that we might not be familiar with that we'd have to do the research on. So it's quite an efficient process. And, you know, we have very skilled analysts and we have a lot of research resources to do that. You know, I'd say out of the 850 stocks that meet the screening parameters, we're then looking just at the stocks. It's kind of like classic stock picking with certain biases to some of the things that we've been talking about, exposures to growth thematics, good corporate governance, you know, stable macro environments. I'd say we get about 80 to 90 stocks that kind of make it out of that stage. And then we construct the portfolio owning the 50 to 60 best ones. And we're also monitoring those other ones. Those stocks kind of make up our prospect list, and those might be the kind of companies we invest in the future.
So you guys have been doing this for a while. The inception of the strategy goes back to 2006. At the end of 2023, there was $995 million in in the strategy. There's different chassis for investing in this. There's a separate account. You have mutual funds. Who is your customer base?
We primarily sell to the big, you know, advisory firms. So, you know, kind of the big six, the Morgan Stanley's, UBS's, JP Morgan's are all, you know, big clients of ours. And then we do have direct relationships too, but I would say, you know, and we do have institutional businesses too, our institutional relationships. We also have offshore businesses. We have, just about over a billion in assets in offshore funds. That's our primary client base. And so we're often selling through financial advisors who sell then to their clients. And oftentimes our products have gone through the due diligence of these firms. And sometimes we're often recommended as well.
You said you've been doing this for over two decades. How did you get involved in this space in the first place?
Yeah, it was kind of interesting. I started at Schaefer Cull, and I started my career actually in education. I thought I wanted to be a teacher, and I used to be a wrestler, and so I wanted to be a wrestling coach and do all these kinds of things. And a lot of my friends who are doing quite well on Wall Street told me that, look, you should really be looking at this. You'd be good at this. And so I kind of switched over, and I got an opportunity at Schaefer Cull in 2000. And back then, we didn't have any non-U.S. strategies. We just had, you know, we were doing our high dividend strategy in the U.S. We had a value strategy, but nothing outside of the U.S. So based on client interest, we had a client who asked us if we would take kind of more of a global approach, start doing more international investing. And Jim Cullen, at that time, I was fortunate enough to sit in his office for about 4 years. So I really got, and that was at a very interesting time when value, of course, was out of favor, right? This is back in 2000 when the tech bubble was blowing up back then. So it was kind of a very interesting time to enter the business. And we decided to take on the client's mandate of a global high dividend strategy. That's the first strategy that I started managing in 2001. We always thought that the emerging markets were kind of one of the more interesting parts of that universe. But then first in 2004, we launched a international high dividend strategy, which is more of a developed market dividend strategy, which I, by the way, also manage. And then after that, in 2005, we launched the emerging market strategy, first in a separately managed account. And then later in 2012, we launched our U.S. mutual fund. And then a few years later, our offshore fund. So that's kind of how I got my start. Basically, what we were trying to do is we were trying to get the same kind of profile we're getting in the U.S., but outside of the U.S. And by that, I mean, we wanted to have a lower volatility strategy that outperformed the market over the long term and generated a nice income stream that had good growth potential. And so it was just a matter of trying to replicate that. And like I said, there were definitely a few curveballs that I had to get up to speed with, mainly due to the country factors. But, over time, I think we've developed a pretty good process to, kind of handle those challenges.
I'm curious to hear your take on if it's easier, obviously it's nothing's easy, if it's less difficult to generate alpha in emerging market stocks. Obviously companies here like, you know, the big ones, Apple, have so much coverage. There's very little edge there. Do you think that the amount of analyst coverage and just general knowledge of these companies, does that actually matter? Are there more greater inefficiencies when there's less people looking at these companies?
Yeah, I think it's definitely fair to say that for me, it's easier to generate alpha in emerging markets than the U.S. for the reasons you said that, yeah, they're just so, the U.S. stocks are just so well followed. There are just a wide variety of inefficiencies in emerging markets. There's those country factors that you have to really be aware of. At the same time, it's still true that your average manager has underperformed the index, you know, over the last, say, 15 years. So it's not that, you know, the majority of managers are generating alpha, but a greater percentage, I think, are doing it. And the other interesting thing is I just think that, you know, in a world where people are so interested in kind of passive and ETFs and that sort of thing, that in emerging markets, I think, you know, really mutual funds make a lot of sense. And I think active management makes a lot of sense. There's just a lot of things that we can do that passive strategies cannot do. I mean, I think it's very, very hard to analyze things like dividend yield and dividend growth consistently if you're trying to do that passively. When the Russian and Ukraine war broke out a few years ago, we were able to completely de-risk our exposure and get basically out of Russia completely, whereas passive approaches, you know, we're stuck with those positions that, you know, generated big losses for them. So there are definitely advantages to being active. And I think that is one of the reasons why you can generate alpha probably a bit easier than compared to the S&P 500. Or in the US.
You mentioned the mutual fund. Is there a particular reason why you've stuck with this structure? Obviously, the exchange traded fund chassis has gotten very popular over the years. What are some of the differences? Like, why haven't you released that?
I think we really haven't had to. I mean, you know, we're getting decent demand. We're also, you know, not. I mean, obviously, we want to grow and do well, but it's not like my goal is just to manage, you know, $10 billion or something like that. It's, you know, we want to manage the money well. That's the biggest goal. We do have a separately managed account product too. The big difference is, is that, you know, you can't get the same access in a lot of the separately managed accounts as you can in a mutual fund, where I can get into places like India or into China, or, you know, even into frontier markets like, you know, Vietnam or Bangladesh if you really wanted to. So that's the big advantage of a mutual fund. You know, we've been asked a lot to run a EM SMA as like an ADR only strategy, but we've always said no to that. Just because we don't think it's really a viable product. So we probably would be managing a lot more if we had said yes to that. But again, we think it would ruin the integrity of the product.
Getting back to Michael, one of Michael's first questions about there being the need for a catalyst, is low valuation alone a catalyst for emerging markets? Do you think there has to be something? Is it going to have to be the fact that U.S. stocks are too expensive and then the dollar falls or whatever? Like what would it take to for emerging markets to take off from here?
Yeah, do we need like an agreement between like China and the U.S.? Like would that... Do we need that, or can these stocks rally absent? Can there be a turnaround absent that?
You know, that would definitely help. Make no mistake about it. I mean, when you look at China, you know, if China traded at, you know, 12 to 14 times earnings 5 to 10 years ago, they just shouldn't be trading at that level anymore, because there should be a geopolitical discount in the stocks owing to the tensions and the fact that they're out there saying that they're going to invade Taiwan, which, you know, that makes me start thinking that they're a bit like Russian stocks. And I frankly think that if they did invade Taiwan, a lot of the sanctions and things that happened to Russian stocks would probably happen to Chinese stocks, which would then make them uninvestable. So it would help a ton if China would say, hey, we're not going to invade Taiwan, or if B, they put more stimulus into their economy so things could start improving. But you don't need that. Like I said, there's too many other opportunities that are making a lot of money and generating, you know, very big returns in those other markets. And so people are just too focused on China and too worried. And so I, you know, yeah, would it help if the dollar started weakening? Definitely. I mean, if you look at the past, I think in the last 10 periods when the dollar went down by 10%, emerging markets were up on average 45%. And the hit rate was 9 out of 10 times. So, you know, that's kind of the mother of all catalysts. But you don't need that. You could just have, you know, company specific catalysts, country specific catalysts. You have these huge trends. Like, you know, I think we're like kind of like living in an interesting world where, you know, we have a lot of problems like high rates, inflation. We have these terrible wars that are going on. But when you look at some of these long-term growth trends like nearshoring, reshoring, like AI, like addressing climate change, and unfortunately these wars too, which create a lot of demand for industrial products, obviously defense munitions and other things, that's a lot of demand. And that's why I think, you know, we haven't really seen kind of a recession yet, and why earnings growth has been very good. And a lot of these emerging market companies are exposed to those, you know, excellent, you know, kind of thematic growth catalysts.
And those countries too are used to experiencing high inflation and high rates, right?
They are. That's been the other, you know, big difference, is that unlike in most emerging markets, rates never went down to zero like they did in developed markets. All right. So they're not going to have to deal with, you know, that refinancing risk that is kind of looming. That's like kind of the elephant in the room, if you ask me. If you look at, you know, developed markets, either in the U.S. or in Europe, that it's true that companies and corporations have done a very good, and individuals have done a very good job at refinancing their risk, refinancing their debt and locking in, you know, their debt at low rates. But at some point, they're going to have to refinance that. And when that goes up at a much higher interest expense, that's going to be a problem for a lot of, you know, companies. And in emerging markets, you have much less of that as a problem because rates never really went down that low. So there's several emerging markets where, you know, rates are actually lower than pre-pandemic levels. And like I said, they've done a lot better. Inflation did not have nearly the negative impact that it had in the past in emerging markets, both because I think, A, they're so experienced either on a company level or country level in dealing with inflation. And then there are other things that happen, like, for example, in Asia, a lot of Asian countries kept buying Russian oil. So all of a sudden, energy prices going through the roof didn't have that negative impact that it typically has. So from that, you know, perspective, I think emerging markets, most emerging markets, certainly not all of them, but most emerging markets are in a much better relative position compared to developed markets with regards to both inflation and refinancing risks.
All right, Rahul, last question for me. You mentioned that they're in a much better position, but if you look at their economic footprint of EM countries versus the rest of the world, they are way underrepresented in the stock market in terms of they account for a lot of the GDP, the population, the growth, and yet they're, whatever, 11% of the global stock market or something like that. What do you think, again, I'm asking you to like predict the future, which is not fair, but how does their stock market weighting grow relative to the rest of the world?
Yeah, I mean, that's definitely a great long-term opportunity that if you look at, for example, like market capitalization, it's about 20% of the global market cap, but, you know, GDP is, you know, over 40%. And probably even more importantly, their contribution to global earnings is probably close to about 40% too. So that is a disconnect that we think over time that you will definitely see convergence. And one of the things that should happen is that stock prices should go up. But there are certain markets where if you look at market cap to GDP, which is something we do look at, that it's already quite advanced. Like a place like Taiwan, I want to say has the largest market cap to GDP of any country in the world, even though it's an emerging market. So it's not just a, you know, an opportunity necessary for all emerging markets. And that's I guess that's the big point of what I'm trying to tell everyone is that you can't just call them emerging markets, right? They're all different. You want to look at each market. There's different opportunities, different risks, different valuations. And so you really kind of have to think of them, you know, one by one and getting together your, you know, collective EM exposure.
Where do we send people to learn more about your strategies?
Well, certainly our marketing team, our website has a lot of information. You know, we love talking to clients and educating them about our strategies. We have a big marketing team that knows the product very well. So, you know, just inquiring with our firm is a great way to start.
All right. Rahul, thank you very much for your time today. We appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you guys so much. Bye now.
Okay, thanks again to Rahul, member Schaefer Cullen Capital Management. That's cullenfunds.com. To learn more, send us an email, animalspirits@compoundnews.com.